I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture. With me, Neil Denny.
This week, we're investigating the world's most mysterious air disasters with aviation journalist Christine Negroni and her book, The Crash Detectives. Christine Negroni is a journalist, aviation blogger, documentary producer and crash investigator with more than 15 years' experience observing and participating in the international effort to create safer skies. She's currently reporting for the New York Times, ABC News and Air and Space, and she's the author of The Crash Detectives, investigating the world's most mysterious air disasters, which we're going to talk about today. Christine, welcome to Little Atoms.
Thank you so much. I'm so glad to be here.
Tell me first of all then, how you got involved in investigating air disasters. The first thing that you did majorly was the TWA Flight 800,
right.
Wasn't it?
Right. That's the how did a nice girl like you wind up writing about disasters question. I get that. So I actually was working as a general reporter for CNN. I was a correspondent at CNN. And there was an airplane crash in 1996 that I and the rest of the New York Bureau was sent out to cover. And I did that. But I found it very intriguing. I mean, this was, interestingly, kind of like Malaysia 370. Mm-hmm. And that there were the people who believed it was a criminal act, and there were the people who believed it was a mechanical issue, and they were fighting, and there were accusations of cover-up, and all of that stuff. And I wound up reporting because I came to believe that the investigation was being manipulated by law enforcement for reasons of their own, but that there was plenty of evidence to suggest that this really was a mechanical issue, and not just a mechanical issue, but one that had been known about for three decades, and yet for various reasons had not been addressed, successfully addressed by the safety authorities. And so, after writing that book, I was like, this is intriguing. This is about machines and it's about people and it's about crime and regulation. It's just so many different things and politics and how things appear to be one thing and turn out to be another. So after that, I went to work for a law firm as an investigator. And this is a law firm that represents people who have died, represents the families of people who have died in airline crashes. And I worked as their investigator, but of course, 9/11 had happened at that time, and we were also working on the 9/11 investigation. So it was like being a reporter, but for a private client. And for them, I did a lot of air crash investigations, large, small, that was my job, in 9/11, so terror was involved as well. And I left that business back in 2008, and I went back into journalism. But now I felt like, I know a specific thing well. I'm a half an inch wide and a meter deep, and that's the thing I want to write about. I felt like I knew it, and I could write about it from a position of comfort.
So you mentioned Malaysia Airlines Flight 370, which is the airline that disappeared somewhere over the Indian Ocean a few years ago. And that was a common thread throughout this book, where you return to that story. And because obviously we don't know what happened. We have clues, but we still don't know what happened to it. And of course, what you're doing here is looking at other examples of, similar accidents or things that we've learned and perhaps trying to surmise what happened. What do we know?
Well, we know that the airplane had been serviced right before the flight, and we know that the captain was an extremely experienced and conscientious pilot. He'd been with Malaysia Airlines for his entire career, and he was an aviation geek. I mean, he loved to fly and did it even when he wasn't flying. He flew a simulator and he did remote control aircraft. I mean, you name it, he did it. He was a big aviation geek. His first officer was very young, 27 years old, but he had also been a pilot for several years on a different kind of aircraft, on an Airbus aircraft. And now he was stepping up to a larger airplane and more responsibility. So he was on his last check ride, his last ride as a student, if you will, before he became certified to fly the 737 as a first officer. So he was essentially the, you know, the inferior person on the aircraft in terms of expertise and knowledge of the aircraft, but in no way unsuited for the flight. We know these things. We know that before the plane took off, it was loaded with a couple of interesting things. It was loaded with mangosteens, which are a Malaysian, I never heard of them before, but they're apparently delicious. And that's a fruit that grows in Malaysia and is a big product in China. But a huge amount of mangosteens, and mangosteens were out of season. So that, you know, is a curious thing that they had on the airplane. They also had lithium ion batteries, and I don't want to say the number off the top of my head because my recollection for numbers isn't good, but it's in the book. A lot, suffice to say, a lot of lithium ion batteries. And these were batteries that were being used, they were Motorola batteries, and they were being used for some Motorola electronic device. Big cargo of that. Now, in the United States and other countries, you can't carry lithium-ion batteries as cargo on passenger flights, but in Malaysia, it's allowed.
And later on in the interview, we're going to come back to those batteries and talk about why that might be.
Right, okay, so there was that. So, and the other interesting thing that happened to the aircraft just prior to the flight is that the oxygen that is used in the case of an emergency to keep the flight crew oxygenated in the case of a decompression, that those tanks had been topped off. They'd been removed from the aircraft, topped off, reinstalled, and reconnected to the mask. So, you know, they always say the first flight after maintenance is the most dangerous flight because you want to make sure that the maintenance guys tightened all the screws. So we know that. So we know that the captain was flying the plane when they first took off. And we know that at some point after they leveled off at 35,000 feet, the first officer took over control of the airplane. And we know that they were at the border of one airspace to another. Malaysia was about to hand the airplane over to Vietnam, or had handed them off to Vietnam. And the only thing remaining to do was for the pilots to get the frequency from Vietnam and dial it in. And there's one more thing we know that I wanted to remind you of. And that was this, because it'll come back in the conspiracy when we talk about conspiracies. The airplane was very close to being out of radar-controlled airspace, out of radar space. In other words, had it continued on its path over the South China Sea towards Beijing, it soon would have been unseeable on radar, because radar's boundary is 200 miles. Once you're 200 miles off any coast, you're no longer seen by radar, not civilian radar. And so that airplane was about to leave radar airspace. After that, what we know is that the plane turned back around toward Kuala Lumpur. But instead of actually going to Kuala Lumpur, it made a turn towards the west, more towards Penang. Then it turned north towards an airplane with a long runway called Langkawi, which, I will say as an aside, we also know was the airfield that the first officer was most familiar with because he had learned to fly there. And it's an airfield with a very long runway, which if you have an airplane that is full of fuel, as this one did, that's where you'd want to put it down because you want more runway because you're landing heavy. We know that. But then it didn't go towards Langkawi. It made that turn up towards and then veered off to the left. And then it veered to the south. And once it started south, no more changes in direction. It was at that point, appeared to be a plane no longer under human control.
Before we talk about what you think happened, I just want to reiterate something you've just said. Like, the plane was at the point where it was going out of radar range. But we've all got, you know, I've got Google Maps on my phone. There are satellites. We've all got GPS in our cars. Yet we still live in a world where you can't tell where a plane is when it's flying over the sea. If it's over the, you know, the middle of the Pacific, for instance, and it's out of range of land.
It's true, and it's interesting because it's not that the industry hasn't wanted to fix that problem. The issue for aviation is it's not as nimble as other digital providers. You know, my phone is replaced every 2 years, every 3 years. The technology that today seems fantastic, tomorrow seems so old-fashioned. And so we're constantly leapfrogging onto newer, newer, newer. But you can't do that in an airplane. Planes are not disposable. You don't get rid of it after 2 years. And so before, I think this is a big part of the issue, before the industry signs on to something that's going to have to be installed on 600 airplanes just for one airline, you know, and that by however many airplanes there are in the world, tens of thousands, I'm sure, they want to know that, okay, we're about to invest X million dollars in this new tracking technology. Is this the technology we're going to be using 5 years down the road? 10 years even? And I'm not so sure anyone can say that now. Can you say it about anything now? And that, I think, is a real dilemma for them. And I don't think that the industry had any idea that things were going to move as fast as they have.
I'm James Ward. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
So let's talk about what you think, you know, bearing in mind the evidence that we have, the likelihood compared to other accidents that have happened. What do you think happened here?
Well, okay, so I left you with the facts. I interrupted the facts from the point of the flight after 35,000 feet, or after it had reached 35,000 feet. And we know the captain turned the airplane, control of the airplane, over to the first officer because the captain was making the radio calls, and that's the way that works. So the first officer's flying the airplane, and now we're getting into Christine Negroni suspects. And the captain decided to leave the cockpit. I think he went to the bathroom, because I have plenty of experience at my age with men who are that age, and that's what they like to do. They go to the bathroom more often than they did when they were younger. And he is a coffee drinker, so he'd have another reason to want to go to the bathroom after 2 hours. I think he got up and maybe just stretched his legs, whatever. He left the cockpit. He went into the bathroom, he went back to talk to a flight attendant, and the first officer's in there alone. And the first officer, like any 27-year-old I can imagine, is thinking, I rule, I rock. I'm in charge of this airplane. It's mine. I'm responsible for this multi-million dollar airplane. I'm taking these people. I'm capable. He's having fun, as anyone would be. And boom, something happens. I don't know where there was a decompression, but there's every reason to believe there was a massive decompression of the aircraft that caused that pilot to immediately lose oxygen, to have her oxygen to come rushing out of his body, because an airplane, a 777, is pressurized to 8,000 feet. And when the airplane decompresses, it goes from 8,000 feet to something in the neighborhood of 35, because that's where they were.
Just to interrupt me there, that was something I didn't know until I read in this book. I would have just presumed that it was sea level, the pressure. Why 8,000 feet?
8,000 feet is actually a legacy of World War II. So when the airlines were trying to think, okay, let's pressurize an airplane, and they don't want to put too much stress on the fuselage, because it's like pressurizing an airplane is the most similar thing is being inside a balloon. You push the air in, and then the walls of the airplane hold it in. So you are in an inflated aluminum tube. And they don't want to go to sea level, because sea level is just that much more pressure. So it really was an engineering decision to how do we make people feel comfortable on a flight without overstressing the aircraft. And we remember the Comet was an airplane that did get overstressed and blow apart. And there were three of them that blew apart.
And we'll get to that a bit later on as well.
I'm leaping ahead from disaster to disaster. I will just skip through the field of disasters. Anyway,
So we're basically at the top of, when you're on a plane, when you fly on the plane, you're basically at the top of a reasonably high hill.
Yeah. Correct. Which is why some people feel lightheaded. That's why alcohol has a more dramatic effect on you, because all that, you know, when alcohol gets into your bloodstream and there's all that oxygen, now you got, less oxygen in there. And some people's color vision is affected. I mean, these are just things that happen. But at any rate, so it's at 8,000 feet, and they lose pressurization. And the first officer knows. I mean, it's not subtle. It would be a bang. The windows of the cockpit would have suddenly turned frosty, because there's all that humidity. Humans emit humidity, and it's 35,000 feet. That's dry and cold, and all of that, humidity in the air turns to ice, and it sticks to the glass. That's what have happened. It would have been chilly for him. He would have felt that cold. Temperature's minus 60 degrees. Sorry, that's Fahrenheit. I can't do the translation, but minus 60 degrees Fahrenheit. It is cold. So he immediately knows he has a problem. One of the first symptoms of hypoxia is trembling of the extremities. He's got shaking hands. He's reaching over with his shaking hands to dial in the emergency frequency on the transponder. He might have even been trying to deal with the Vietnamese at this time, because that was the task that was left to him. But he turns the transponder, instead of turning it to 7700, which is the international emergency code, he turns it to standby. And that's that. I don't think he did it intentionally. I think he inadvertently put it to standby in an attempt to notify people that he had a problem. And now he puts his mask on. And here's the second problem. He puts his mask on, and instead of getting 100% oxygen under pressure, which would be required at that altitude to rejuvenate him, he could be alive with less. But to rejuvenate him and bring him back to mental function, he needs, it's like putting your face up to an air conditioning vent. He puts the mask on and he waits to feel better, or he hopes to feel better. And he probably does a little, but he's not getting what he needs to resuscitate him intellectually. And from that point on, everything he does is idiotic because he doesn't have the mental capacity. There's not enough oxygen feeding his brain. So he turns the plane around. I'll take it back to Kuala Lumpur. But then he thinks, no, not Kuala Lumpur. I'll take it to Penang. So he takes it to Penang. Then he thinks, wait a minute, Langkawi might be better. I got an airplane. It's heavy. I can land this airplane there. I know the runway, you know, in my sleep. But he doesn't go to Langkawi either. Maybe he's overshot it. Maybe he thinks he's going to go back. Maybe he doesn't know what the hell's going on. Very likely that. He turns the plane to the south, and that's the end of him. That's when he loses consciousness or dies. Everyone else in the back, you know, has been dead for a while because those oxygen masks only give you 12 minutes worth of oxygen. So they've been dead for a while. The captain's never able to get out of the bathroom. He's back there in the bathroom, or he's back with the flight attendant. He's got a fairly long walk back to the cockpit. I don't think he could have made it.
And then the plane would have just carried on flying until it ran out of fuel.
Now we're back into fact territory when we talk about the plane running out of fuel, because we know how much fuel was loaded on the airplane. Mm-hmm. So we know how long the plane could have flown. And we know how long the plane had power because of the Inmarsat satellites. So we know the plane had power for about the same amount of time as the plane had fuel. So that we know.
As I mentioned, this surmise comes from looking at other examples of accidents that have happened where a similar thing has occurred. And I wanted to talk about an example of decompression, which is the Greek flight, Helios Flight 522. Tell us about that accident.
Well, Helios 522 happened in 2005, and Malaysia 370 happened in 2014. So I was in Malaysia at the time when we learned, so I came there maybe a week after, six days after it disappeared, but right around the time that they first announced, the Malaysians first announced, oh, the plane was actually flying. Don't double check me on the timing, 6 days, whatever. But I can tell you for a fact, I was there when they came out and said, we have an announcement to make. The plane was flying for 7 hours. That was huge. I mean, we were like, what do you mean it was flying? Because everyone thought the plane had crashed. You know, something had happened. It had crashed into the South China Sea on its way to Beijing. This was like earth shaking for us. And that's when I thought, flying 7 hours, same course for the last 5 hours. This sounds like Helios 522. That's what I'm thinking. I knew about Helios 522 because I had written a lengthy article about decompression, hypoxia, and other cases. I know over here in the UK, they're very enthusiastic about golf and Payne Stewart. He was our American golf hero, and he had died in a case just like that. The plane lost pressurization. The pilots didn't realize it or couldn't do anything about it, so everyone fell unconscious, and the plane continued on until it ran out of fuel. Payne Stewart led me to Helios, and Helios is a somewhat similar story and somewhat different. It's different in that airplane took off, and the pilots probably failed to pressurize the aircraft. Maybe they had a mechanical problem. We don't know why it failed to pressurize. We do know it did not pressurize. Mm-hmm. So the plane takes off, and it's fine. Everything's fine. Everything's normal. But at about 10,000, 12,000 feet, they get an alarm, and the alarm and the oxygen masks drop. So now they should know they have a problem with pressurization of the aircraft. Unfortunately, they were both smokers as well. They didn't realize that they were already suffering the effects of oxygen deprivation. Mm-hmm. Because rather than hear the alarm and think, oh, we have a pressurization problem, let's put on our masks, they think, oh, we have a problem with the takeoff configuration, let's fix the problem. So they start trying to work on a problem they don't have without putting their masks on. And then they both fall unconscious. So the plane continues. It's on autopilot to Athens. It continues to climb. It reaches cruise altitude. It heads towards Athens. 2 hours pass. Everyone in the airplane is surely dead because they don't have any oxygen except for one guy. He's a flight attendant who's also training to be a pilot. And he, remarkably, has gotten a hold of the flight crew oxygen bottles, each of which holds a half an hour of oxygen. And he is running through these bottles, one after another, keeping himself alive. What he hasn't done is gone into the cockpit to find out what's gone on. But after 2 hours, he's at the end of his last bottle. Now he goes in. And he goes into the cockpit and he sees the frosted glass. He sees the first officer dead over the yoke. He sees the captain dead behind a seat. He sits down in the captain's seat. He puts the captain's air mask, oxygen mask on, and proceeds to say, "Mayday, mayday." He knows he's in trouble. He's getting oxygen now. And the Greek fighter pilots who are on either side of the airplane, they've been dispatched because this plane is flying in Greek airspace without any kind of radar, radio. They're trying to figure out why nobody's talking and there's no, you know, and there's no communication from this flight crew. And they see the guy enter the cockpit and now they figured it out because they're pilots. They know what frosted windshield means. It means that airplane has no pressurization, and if nobody's talking, it's because they're dead. So they see the guy enter. They must have been kind of thrilled with that, and they motion, "Follow us." But he can't follow them because they're 7 minutes away from running out of fuel. Mm-hmm. So he fumbles around, but the first engine begins to run out of fuel, and then the second, and then the plane crashes into the side of a mountain.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny, and today I'm talking to Christine Negroni. We're talking about her book, The Crash Detectives, Investigating the World's Most Mysterious Air Disasters. And Christine, we were talking for quite a while in the first part about Malaysia Air's Flight 370. And again, people might think, you know, this idea of a new state-of-the-art airline just disappearing and us having no idea what happened to it. It must be, you know, a one in a million event. But it has happened before. And you talk about, well, way back in 1938, the story of a Pan Am flying boat, the Hawaii Clipper. Tell us that story.
Well, the Hawaii Clipper really caught my attention because it was Malaysia 370 70 years earlier. It's kind of remarkable. You know, the older I get, the more I see that, you know, history, you just change the names and a few of the details. But generally speaking, we just do the same things over and over again. The Hawaii Clipper, this plane was a flying boat, as you said, a beautiful flying boat. And it was hopscotching as they did across the Pacific Islands on their way to, the ultimate destination was the Philippines. And it was leaving Guam. So it was not, I think, the fifth day of the flight. It was leaving Guam and headed towards the Philippines. And they were radioing to the base in the Philippines, and they had encountered some rain, and they said, "Hang on." The pilot said, "Hang on, we got some," or the radio operator, "we got some rain here, we'll ring you back." And then they never did, and that was the last they heard. So, you know, they sent out boats to look around, but nothing showed up. I mean, there was no airplane, no passengers, no luggage, no nothing. And briefly they found some oil on the water, which they thought, oh, maybe it's aviation fuel, which interestingly happened with Malaysia 370. They thought they found some oil in the South China Sea, but they never did, and they never found anything. And it turned out the oil was not aviation fuel. So, you know, the other interesting thing that happened with the Hawaii Clipper was that all of these people started talking about, oh, it must have been the Japanese. The Japanese must have hijacked the plane, and they stole the technology of the engines. And, you know, there was an us versus them at the time, because we were coming up to, the Western world was coming up to World War II, and the Japanese were the enemy. And here we are in Malaysia 370 and 214. I remember some of the first coverage was that this was a Muslim nation, and, you know, there were many Islamic people there, and could it be an active Islamic terrorism? The same sort of fear of us versus them. And I think that fed a lot of the rumors that in Malaysia 370, the plane had been, you know, the pilots had taken it for a suicide, or that someone had taken it as an act of Islamic terrorism. But in neither case was there evidence that could lead you to that conclusively. Now, there was a little bit in the Hawaii Clipper to suggest the Japanese had been trying to sabotage the flying boat. They had issues with Pan Am, with an American company setting up bases in the Pacific in islands that were not supposed to be under the control of the military. So there were some reasons to believe that the Japanese might have had a hand in it. But look, they've never found anything. And, you know, no one's talked. So yeah, at this point, it could just as well have been an accident like this. I mean, look, aviation wasn't as safe there as it is now. It's a flying boat, you know, they blew up and they sunk and, you know, lots of things could have happened.
But also just the idea of crossing the Pacific in those days, this was a service flying from San Francisco to the Philippines. And that would have taken 4 or 5 days.
Right.
They would do these hops
from
one island to another, to Guam and where have you. You also talk in the book about, you know, the disappearance of Amelia Earhart and a very similar thing. You know, there was an island that she was supposed to be aiming for somewhere in the middle of the Pacific, never made it.
Right. They sort of beg the question, like, yeah, she could have been kidnapped by the Japanese, but if you were to place, like, the likely outcomes for a woman who was not proficient in radio navigation, whose navigator was a known alcoholic, who she expressed concerns about days before the flight, if you take a look at the fact that the island was 1 mile wide in the middle of a vast ocean that she was approaching overnight, if you take a look at those factors, and that she had saved the most difficult part of her journey for the end, when she was most fatigued and concerned, all of that sounds more like she failed because there were a lot of factors working against her. Yeah, it could have been this, but it looks more like a duck. I don't know whether you have that here, but we say if it looks like, if it squawks like a duck, it looks like a duck to me. It doesn't look like an act of piracy or terrorism. And in Malaysia 370, there's enough evidence from what I uncovered to suggest something that looks more like a duck than something that looks like a case of terrorism or hijacking.
Okay, let's look at a disaster where there's a lot of conspiracy theories around it. And it does indeed look incredibly murky. This is the plane crash that killed the UN Secretary General Dag Hammarskjöld in Africa in 1961.
Right.
There's lots of weird inconsistencies with this one.
Yeah, oh no, there are. And then the other thing is, and this happens, I mean, Malaysia's, you know, it may be politically more complicated. Actually, we're all pretty complicated these days, but it may be more of a strongman government than some of the countries where other accidents were investigated. But certainly, when we're talking about the Congo in the days of decolonization, when all sorts of craziness was happening. I mean, were the Brits in charge? Were the Belgians in charge?
And
you know, were the Congolese I mean, you know, when just that cast of characters is like, I don't think we're going to get a completely unbiased investigation. We got to start with that. You know, so there was that. I mean, there was the fact that bullets were found in the bodies of some of the passengers, and there would be no, unless somebody on the plane shot someone, there's no way for those bullets to be in the bodies of the passengers. So that in itself is odd. And the plane crashed into the woods and everybody else in the airplane is still in the airplane. But Dag is propped against a tree. I mean, these just things defy explanation. And then there's a survivor who everyone who, when they see him, thinks, oh, he's not in such bad shape. Great, we have a survivor who mysteriously dies a week later, whose all of his conversations were tape recorded, but the tape can't be found. I mean, you look at things like that and you think, yeah, this doesn't look like a duck to me. This does not look like a duck. This looks like one of the turkey gooses or something. There's a lot of different things on it.
Okay, let's talk about we've been talking about, you know, a couple of crashes where there are conspiracy theories around them. And, you know, and I say conspiracy theories in that way. Far-fetched conspiracy theories is obviously what I mean by that. I want to talk about one which I think is probably the most shocking story in the book, which really happened, where there was a conspiracy and a cover-up. And this is Air New Zealand Flight 901. And a disaster that happened in my lifetime, and this was the first time I'd ever heard of it. And it's an amazing story.
It is. It really is. And, you know, I think I made it the last one in my section on conspiracies. And the way I describe it is, if you told somebody this story, they'd think you were crazy. But all of the evidence is there. And, you know, to add to it, I knew Ron Chippendale because we were members of the same organization, the International Society of Air Safety Investigators. He was a well-respected, and I only knew him as a passing acquaintance, but people whose opinion I know and respect knew and respected his opinion. So it was really incredible to me, but the evidence speaks for itself. The plane was flying on a sightseeing flight over, they leave Auckland, they fly down, 4 hours down, people are given champagne. I mean, it's like a first-class flight the whole way in a big DC-10. They fly down, there's an expert, an Antarctica expert on board who gives them
commentary. We should say this is a sightseeing trip from New Zealand to Antarctica.
Thank you for keeping me on track. So they're on this sightseeing trip, and they're, you know, they go down, they spend the 4 hours down, and maybe, you know, 60 minutes flying around, and then they go back up. That's the day. And they do this once a week, 1 month a year as a special treat. And they've done it for 2 years when this accident happened.
And we should say this is a big plane. This DC-10, is a DC-10. Big, yeah, this is not plane. Like a little tiny trip with 40 people on board.
Yeah. It's a big
airliner.
Yeah, I mean, it's not as big as a 747, but almost. I think it was built as a competitor to the 747. So they're flying down there, and the pilots who had none of them had ever flown the route before. Well, I shouldn't say that the flight engineer had, but the pilot and the co-pilot had not ever flown the route before, but they had done a tutorial. And they'd done this tutorial and simulator session in which they were told the route they would fly. They would fly in over the ocean, over the sea ice. They would do the circuit around the base, and then they would fly back. So they get to the airport, and the captain studies it the night before. There's this lovely story about him showing his daughters, because they were all excited he was going to fly to Antarctica. You know, he shows them where he's going to go and blah, blah, blah. So they get on the plane, and in the last minute they say, there's just new coordinates. I don't think they told them there were new coordinates, but they were given the coordinates to put into their navigation system. And they just entered them. They would have no way of knowing that those were not the coordinates that they had flown in the simulator. But these new coordinates take them right into Mount Erebus, not over the sea ice. Mount Erebus is 11,000 feet. So they're flying, and you know, now they're going to descend and take a look around because the air is clear, and they descend, and bam, they fly right into a mountain. Well, you say, well, if the air was clear, how could they fly into a mountain? Well, what they didn't know, which we learn, is that in certain meteorological conditions, a white mountain against a white sky and white snow will disappear. So they're looking out of their window and they see nothing. Meanwhile, there's a volcano right in front of them. But they didn't see it because of this thing called sector blindness. So that's the story. But what is kept from the public, all they know is the pilot descended into a mountain. And at one point, the Civil Aviation Authority says, we can only presume that both of them were crazy. You know, that they both were struck with a mental illness. That's his theory about what happened. So what they don't know, I mean, what the general public doesn't know, is that both of these pilots had spoken to their families and everyone else about they thought they were flying over sea ice. But the people who changed the coordinates right before the flight, well, they know they changed the coordinates. So they tell the boss, but the boss doesn't tell anybody else. Let's keep it secret because our changing of the coordinates made them fly into a mountain. And that's really the cover. That's the initiation of the cover-up. They don't want anyone to know that they changed the coordinates at the last minute. And it doesn't come out until, I think, an accident happened in November. Sometime in February, a newspaper reporter gets fed the story, and he writes it, and no one picks up on it because they don't understand what that means. Oh, they changed the coordinates. What does that mean? And so it continues to be sort of the pilots were just crazy and they flew into a mountain. They killed all these people. So it doesn't come out until like the following April or May. And then, you know, it starts to become clear because now all the pilots and their wives and families are aware of what's happened. They start saying, no, no. If you change the coordinates, that means that they didn't know they were flying over the ocean anymore. So that's the story.
I mean, it went further than that. The airline burgled one of the pilots' house. And
maybe
stole
both.
Documents.
Maybe both. There's reason to believe they actually went into both. But only the wife of the first officer knows for a fact that things were taken from her home. The captain's wife reported that her house had been broken into, but could never find anything missing. So, you know, they conclude, since the first officer's house was burgled, that it was probably the airline as well. But also changing information. I mean, the airline was involved in convincing the investigator that certain things that were said on the cockpit voice recorder were not said. I mean, to delete 53 things that the committee had heard and to add words that the committee had not heard, something that's unheard of in accident investigations. So, you know, to make it sound as if the pilots didn't know where they were. Yeah, so there was just a lot of craziness. But, you know, interestingly, they never actually, that Air New Zealand, I think actually, I shouldn't say that. In the past couple of years, I think Air New Zealand finally issued an apology. But the government has never withdrawn the report suggesting that the pilots flew into the mountain, saw it, and flew into it. They never, even though there are now two official reports, they are two reports in conflict. They've never rescinded the original one, which was the product of this cover-up.
I'm Michael Brooks. You're listening to Resonance FM, and this is Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
Another theme of this book, obviously, is about investigating crashes, and we can learn from those crashes. Obviously, the airlines are supposed to learn. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. But take lessons from the crashes and make air travel safer. I want to look at a few examples of where perhaps we've learned something or indeed haven't. And first of all, you've already mentioned the so glamorous de Havilland Comet, the first jet passenger airline, which, as we now know, was just a disaster waiting to happen. Tell us the story of the comet.
You don't want to be the first. You really don't. You know, I met a fellow from Airbus the other day, and we were talking about the Dreamliner and its lithium-ion battery problems, which are in the book. And he said, yeah, you know, I said, well, I guess Airbus is pretty happy it happened to the Dreamliner first, because you could go back and fix. And in fact, that's the case. I mean, that is both the glory and the penalty of being the first out, is that people learn from your mistakes. In the case of the Comet, they had this amazing jet aircraft, and they'd done a lot of things right, but they didn't do everything right, and they didn't know. And, you know, they knew the plane was coming apart, but they just didn't know why. They had other issues with the way the plane took off, its handling characteristics close to the ground, because they were all transitioning from propeller planes to jets, and the aerodynamics are different. So, you know, they were learning as they went along. Unfortunately, they had three accidents in which a number of people died before they figured out what the problem was. And the airplane became, I mean, the second version and the third version became apparently quite robust and reliable. But I think that the Comet 4s were flying into the 1980s. You can't argue with that. But sometimes learning can be painful.
Well, I said we were going to talk about the lithium-ion batteries again, and you've just mentioned them again. So tell us about the story of the Boeing Dreamliner 787 and its battery saga.
Yeah. Well, you know, when I was talking to the fellow from Airbus and someone else, this was at a discussion at the Royal Aeronautical Society, so there were a lot of people involved in the conversation. Someone said, you know, but you gotta credit Boeing for making a remarkable aircraft. I mean, it is a remarkable aircraft. No question about it. But I said, listen, I wouldn't be so hard on Boeing. They did make a great aircraft, but I wouldn't be so hard on them if they didn't know from 2006 onward that the lithium-ion battery was volatile and unpredictable and complicated. And that they did know. Because at the very same time that Boeing was saying, we want to have an airplane that's just relies on electrics far more fuel efficient, we want to save weight, let's use a battery, let's use a whole new kind of battery, let's use a lithium-ion battery, the same time they're saying that, the industry, the electronics industry, is having its largest ever recall of lithium-ion cobalt oxide batteries. The very same chemistry Boeing wants to use. So, you know, the whole computer, camera, personal electronic device industry is saying, eek, lithium-ion, we got some problems, and pulling them off. Boeing is saying, yeah, let's put it on. And it was so unknown. I mean, in the battery industry, they understood lithium-ion batteries. But when Boeing was applying to put the battery on the airplane, because it was new and they had to apply for certification of it, they said, look, we'll put this battery on, but we will make sure it will never fail. It will never go into thermal runaway. It will never emit smoke. We will make sure this will not happen. We'll never have a fire. And then people are asked, so FAA says, okay, well, I hear your promise. Let's put it out to the industry. This is how rules are made in America. Let's put it out to the industry and hear their comments. Well, only one entity, and I can tell you, when they put stuff out for comments, you hear from a lot of like obscure companies that make widgets and everything else with their opinion. Nobody in the industry, it came out, it was like a vacuum. Nobody had anything to say about lithium-ion batteries on the airplane except the pilots' union. And the pilots' union put a couple of papers forward saying, well, you know, lithium-ion could be fires, could be bad, we're not so sure. And the reason that they didn't even have that much on it is because they didn't know. Even the pilots didn't know about lithium-ion batteries. But they thought what they'd heard was not good, and they thought they should at least be on the record. So they put these things forward. And then, so that's when Boeing says, okay, great, I understand you got a fire concern, I understand you got a smoke concern, we'll make sure there is none. And they promised there would be none. And then two times in the progress of improving this battery and getting it onto the airplane, two times they wound up with a big problem with the lithium-ion battery. And two times Boeing went back and said, maybe we should reconsider our choice of power source. And two times they said, nah, let's just go with it. So when the lithium-ion battery goes onto airplanes and they start in service, and then within 10 days they wind up with two events, I get that the new adopter has to recognize that there may be problems. But they had to know. They'd seen the problems from 2006 to 2011. For them to then say, we had no idea the batteries would do this, just begs the question, why didn't you know? They never consulted people in the industry about batteries. They kept the whole thing in-house. The people making the batteries, the GS Yuasa, had never made a battery for this kind of application. I mean, everywhere you looked, it was not well thought out.
We should perhaps say what the issue with the battery was, because, you know, we've all got batteries. Again, this is not a battery running out of power. This is very much a Samsung Note.
It's a Samsung
issue.
Yeah, it's a right. That's why I think I don't need to explain lithium-ion batteries anymore. I did until Samsung Note 7. After that, yeah. I mean, in fact, when I talk to audiences that don't know a lot about aviation, and I say lithium-ion batteries, pause, Samsung 7. You know, they get it. They're all nodding. They get it. Yeah. I mean, these are batteries that, when they catch fire,
it really goes
their,
on fire.
Right, they create their own fuel. There is a fellow, and I talk about him in my book, there is a fellow who is investigating lithium-ion batteries, lithium-ion, the chemistry, the way they catch fire as a low-energy nuclear reaction. He thinks they're so, you know, what we think is scary and scary and scary, he thinks, wow, we could create a nuclear energy source. So if anyone's talking about a nuclear energy source in a battery that's going on an airplane, I'm thinking that's not such a good idea, and I don't think I'm alone. But rather than, after they had these problems and, you know, and they came up with a solution in which they'd put the battery in a titanium housing, and they'd put the housing inside the airplane, and then you run a big chimney out the side so that if the battery fails, all the smoke will go outside and it can burn itself out because it's in titanium. They'd let the airplanes fly again, and darned if there weren't more battery failures. So now we've got battery failures, and I call up because I think this is a story separate from my book, because I was still writing the book, but I was still doing journalism. I called up the FAA, and I said, listen, tell me how many, since the fix, how many batteries have had failures similar to the pre-fix, you know, to the Japan Airlines issues? And she said, I can't tell you. What do you mean you can't tell me? She said, I can't tell you because we're not keeping track. The airplane manufacturer that said we will not have fire, we will not have smoke, is now reduced to we will have fire, we will have smoke, and we don't even have to tell you when. And that's the state of the Dreamliner in 2017.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Little Atoms. I'm Neil Denny. Today I'm talking to Christine Negroni. We're talking about the crash detectives investigating the world's most mysterious air disasters. And Christine, we'd mentioned a couple of cases where there's been a problem with a plane or the equipment, but in the investigation, the pilots are blamed. The Air New Zealand disaster being one of them. But there are pilot errors, right? Pilots are human, and a lot of disasters are caused by pilot errors. And once these disasters happen again, there is things done, steps taken to try and prevent those. And I want to talk about, well, what still remains the worst air disaster, the Tenerife 1977 disaster. Remind us what happened there, and then we can talk about, there was a culture of macho, right stuff, the pilot is always right.
Right. And if you go back and look at movies from the 30s and 40s, The High and the Mighty and films like that, I mean, the captain slaps the first officer. I mean, truly, it was a very different culture. But in the Tenerife disaster, that was actually a rather small airport, or small in comparison to Gran Canaria, which is where everybody went. I mean, I guess it's a big tourist destination in Europe. In America, we don't know it so well. But, you know, they would send in these big Boeing 747s. The Boeing 747 had been flying for 3 or 4 years. It was a very glamorous airplane, and they'd bring these hundreds and hundreds of tourists into Gran Canaria for what you go to a resort for. And there was a bomb threat at that airport. I think it's called Los Rodeos Airport. And because of the bomb threat, they had to take all these jumbo jets and divert them to another airport until that, you know, they were able to reopen the airport at Los Rodeos. So they sent them into Tenerife, and you know, and then there are just piles and piles of 747s and every other kind of large airplane, you know, waiting for the airport in Gran Canaria to open. And then when they open the airport, they start sending the 747s back out. So because it is a small airport, and people were parked, planes were parked on one of the runways or the taxiways, they would send the airplanes down, taxiing down the runway. Then at the end of the runway, they'd turn around and take off. And there'd be somebody behind, a plane behind the first one, and that plane would veer off onto a taxiway while the first plane was taking off. Then the second plane would pull on out and then take off. So in other words, at some point in time, this is a complicated way of explaining that, at some point in time, one airplane would be facing the other airplane, and the plane that was going to take off had to wait until the plane he was facing pulled off the taxiway. Now, it is sunny when this operation begins. But after the first, and two planes take off, and the next two come down, the KLM 747 is first, and he turns around, he lines up, and he's got clear skies. But where the other 747 is, about a mile down the runway, he's in fog. He can't see anything. And he thinks it's foggy, they've closed the airport again. So he's looking for the taxiway, but he's in fog, he can't see it. So they're kind of creeping along, but they're not in any big rush or any big hurry because he thinks the airport's closed. Meanwhile, back in the sunny side of the airport, the captain is thinking, we got to get this airplane going. I'm almost meeting my flight duty times, meaning if I don't get to Gran Canaria by a certain time, I'm going to have to overnight or be in violation. If I have to overnight, 240 or 350 or however many people who are going to get on this plane, they're going to have to overnight. And that's going to cost the company a lot of money. So he wants to take off. So he starts to take off. And the first officer says to him, are they clear? Are they clear? And I'm getting that a little bit confused. But the point is, he wants to take off and the first officer doesn't. Mm-hmm. But he indicates in a somewhat hesitant way that maybe the other 747 isn't off the runway. And at first the captain pauses, but after a minute he says, we go. And they take off. And so they're rolling down the runway. Meanwhile, the Pan Am is still in the fog. He can't see the KLM. And just as it gets close enough so that he can see it, the first officer starts screaming, pull off, pull off, pull off. And the KLM 747 sees it's got a 747 in front of him. He just pulls the yoke back. He's not at takeoff speed, but he pulls the yoke back just to get up in the air. And he gets up in the air, but he can't sustain it. And it clips off the roof of the 747. So big fire. I mean, the airplane, the KLM, had just been refueled. Big fire results. 60-some-odd people survive, and everyone else, 500 and change, die in the fire. That's why the biggest airline disaster in the world at the time, and even to this day, and biggest disaster in one accident. But the second part was, people were like, how did that captain get it so wrong? How did two other officers on the flight deck, having concern that the runway was not cleared, why did they not speak up? And that equation, that's where the captain's the boss and you're just there to sort of get his coffee. Mm-hmm. That equation began to shift that day. And here we are, we're many years later, we still have accidents in which this happens. But it's not considered good airmanship anymore to not speak your mind when there's a safety issue, regardless of what your position is on the airplane.
Being an airline pilot is obviously, you know, an incredibly difficult, responsible, also glamorous job. It's not for everybody. You talk about, you know, you take some of the aptitude tests and over the course of this book that the pilots have to take. And you also talk about a particularly Lufthansa's pilot school. Let's talk about how pilots are selected.
Well, Lufthansa is very conscientious about hiring its pilots, and they undergo 2 weeks of selection before they even get picked to go on the program. And there's financial incentive for that because they're going to train them. They're going to teach them how to fly, and that's a big investment. They're probably $1 million ahead by the time you've gotten them through their flight school. So they want to make sure that, you know, they're going to stick it out. You know, and so they do things like decision-making skills and ability to multitask and, you know, placidity of personality without being too placid. And, you know, I talk about the strengths and the weaknesses, but the line they give you at Lufthansa is you can train anyone to fly, but you can't give them the kind of personality they need. That, you know, they either have or they don't. Mm-hmm. To be able to be unflappable, to be able to listen to others, but be decisive. To be, you know, be flexible if things change, but stick with the standard operating procedures. You know, there really is a balance there. Now, having said that, Lufthansa is the very flight school that accepted Andres Lubitz.
Andreas,
thank you
Lubitz.
For helping me with my memory.
I was going to bring him up.
Andreas Lubitz. You know, they accepted him into the program. And, you know, within the first few months of his flight training, before he even comes to learn how to fly just at ground school, it's so difficult that he has a nervous breakdown and drops out. And then knowing that he has this, you know, problem with depression, accept him back, send him to flight school. And, you know, so you have to wonder, well, they say their screening is very difficult, but sometimes people fall through the gaps.
So he goes on to pilot a, what's the airline called?
German Wings. Eurowings now, but it was German Wings.
The German Wings, which is the Lufthansa's, you know, diffusion range, shall we say.
Low-cost carrier.
He goes on to deliberately pilot the plane into a mountain. You then give a, you know, rather alarming list of other examples of where something similar has happened. How often does that happen?
Now, I'm going to challenge that. In the movie Annie Hall, do you remember the movie Annie Hall when he and Diane Keaton, they go to the shrink, and he says, the shrink says to Woody Allen, how often do you have sex? He says, never, three times
a week.
Yeah. And then Annie Hall says, all the time, once or three times a week, whatever it is. And then, and that what you just said is like you give this horrifying list. And I'm thinking the whole point of that list was to show how infrequent it is.
You give a list of about six examples where
six examples
where pilots
in basically the history of aviation.
Okay. Okay, so
or
these,
whatever.
These are all of the examples ever where a pilot
when
has
you
deliberately
think of
crashed a plane.
How many flights there are. And some of them even, you know, Egypt Air, some people say wasn't, you know, Silk Air, some people argue. I just think that it's not, you know, that's a very small number. But yes, it has happened. It has happened. There's no question about it. It has happened. But, you know, part of aviation safety is that you work with what is, you fix what is likely to happen. Because if you go to everything that could happen, if, you know, everything could happen. You could make an airplane that couldn't fly because it has so many, you know, protections. You have to look is, where are most people at risk? Mm-hmm. And in the United States, and maybe in the UK, I don't know, but in the United States, before you can make a rule that says, for example, fuel tanks cannot be in an explosive state. You have to put an inerting system in. Fuel tanks cannot be in an explosive state. That's a new law, came about in 2006. So when designing new airplanes, they have to design that you won't have hot tanks. Before they could actually make that law, they had to go and look at every fuel tank explosion that had ever been, how many people died, and do the math. If every person is worth, and I'm going to pick a number because I don't remember off the top of my head, but let's say it's $2.3 million. If every human life is worth 2.3 and we've lost 100 people times 2.3 equals X, how much would it cost to put the fix on the airplane? And if that X is lower than the loss of people, they won't do it. Mm-hmm. But if the X is lower than the loss of people, they will do it. But if the X is larger, if it's going to cost more than the loss of human life, they won't do it. And it sounds very cruel. But you do have to say, how much do you want to spend on a fix? of a problem you're not likely to have. It does make sense. You make those decisions every day. Mm-hmm. Am I going to repair my washing machine? I'm going to sell the house in 3 years or not? That's a cost-benefit analysis.
Okay, well, I've sort of besmirched the honour of pilot there. And let's finish off the interview getting that back. You spend time at the end of the book talking about ways in which pilots, you know, their knowledge and experience, teamwork between colleagues, their ability to make decisions is important, remains important. And everybody will know that planes are getting more and more automated. There's this idea that planes nowadays almost fly themselves. Are they too automated? How dangerous is it that planes are getting more and more automated? Or is that a good thing, do you think?
You know, I'm going to say I'm 50... I could argue that either side. How much sex are you having? Too much once a week or not enough once a week? You can argue both sides of that because it depends on the perspective you're looking at. Automation, when airplanes automate certain functions, they do it because the machine is a better and more reliable calculator of the data. So they can put in the math. How long is the runway? How wet is the runway? How much does this airplane weigh? And figure out in a matter of seconds how much stopping distance this airplane is going to need to do, and then make that happen on the airplane. That's an automated landing. And under certain conditions, it's probably better to have the plane do it than the pilot. Now, here's the flip side of that. The flip side of that is that if you have pilots doing automated landings, especially the tricky ones, too much, they lose their ability to do the tricky landings. And what do they do when they must? And that's the yin and the yang of automation. Mm-hmm. Because the machine can do some things better. And one of the things it can do better is strip pilots of their skills, of their flying skills. Now, it may be, I like to think I'm moving with the innovations of the world. It may be that we are just in a transition period. And the pilots who are what they call stick and rudder pilots, you know, they learn to fly as kids and they feel, you know, they feel the weight of the airplane and they, you know, they got it. The Lindberghs, you know, the Lindbergh era flyers. That stick and rudder pilots will not be here forever. But the pilots who are the 27-year-olds, you know, who flight simulators since they were three and understand the computer, that can take my phone and, you know, fly an airplane with it because they understand technology, they'll be the pilots of tomorrow. And they may have a better relationship with automation. They may understand the technology. So it could be that we're in that transition period. I hear pilots my age and older saying things like, you know, pilots have lost their stick and rudder skills. You know, this is bad for safety. I'm not so sure I agree. I think it's a different skill. We're entering a new time when new skills are needed.
Well, the reverse of that then is when one of those more and more automated and technologically marvelous planes goes down, then it becomes more difficult to work out what happened because the people that are investigating it don't have that technological knowledge.
Well, this is true. And we found, and I'm so glad you brought this up because I did want to talk about sort of the citizen investigator, the armchair investigator, of which I am one, because we've entered a time in which the tin kickers, air crash investigators are called tin kickers. And they're called tin kickers because that's what they did. But they don't do so much of that anymore. Look at Malaysia 370. We learned what happened to Malaysia 370 not from people who do aviation. We learned from people who do satellite technology and complex math. And they're the ones who told us this plane went there, not here. This plane was powered on, not crashed into the sea. So that's a whole new thing. And I think we will have, I think that we will have more technological armchair cyber contributors to air accident investigations, and the tin kickers, the folks who know engines and metallurgical fracture rates and all of that, they'll still be required, but they need to learn a new trade, or they need to get different people in there. And they still is a lot of concentration on the mechanical side of airplane accidents, when really the bulk of them are much more on the human performance side. And I don't mean by that just a pilot. I'm talking about operations people and mechanics and ramp workers and all sorts of people who come in contact with airplanes. So, you know, I think it is a new day. I think it is a new day. And air crash investigations need to evolve. And I feel like I'm on the bleeding edge of that by contributing with the crash detectives, contributing a scenario that could have happened in which I did the research, sometimes in my pajamas, on the internet. And here's information that I called the Australians, for example, on page 46 and said, can this cause that? Because I know you have the report. And they said, I don't know, because they're not looking, because they're too much kicking the tin and not enough kicking the digits.
Okay, well, just one more question then and we'll finish. And, you know, we've been talking for the past hour about air crashes, inevitably, you know, some lurid examples of, of things going wrong. But again, the point of this book is really to get across the idea that you quote a famous story of a pilot at some point pulling into the gate and saying, ladies and gentlemen, you've arrived, you know, you're, that's the safest part of your journey over now or something. And, you know, we keep on saying that air travel is incredibly safe. Now, if I had just, you know, wandered into the W.H. Smith's at Heathrow Airport and picked up this book and started leafing through it, convince
and
me
I hope everyone will, and I hope everyone will do just that.
Convince me that I should actually get on the plane.
You get on a plane. I will so do that. Thank you for that question. You get on a plane, like millions of others, every day. You depart from point A and you land at point B and nothing happens to you. You are in absolute safety. And that's because everything we've learned from disasters past has made it safer for you. That's why we're so safe. That's what aviation has, as far as I'm concerned, to offer the world. How the lessons of flying can make you a better person, a better communicator, a better decision maker. All of these things come from aviation. And the other thing is, we are where we are today because of the human-centered nature of aviation. And the results are awe-inspiring. There's just no other way to say it. That, to me, is a happy ending, even to a book called The Crash Detective.
Well, that indeed is a perfect place for us to finish. So I've been talking to Christine Negroni. We've been talking about The Crash Detectives, investigating the world's most mysterious air disasters, which is out now from Atlantic. Christine, thank you so much for coming in and sharing it with me.
Thank you. This was a lot of fun. We really got our geek on.
You've been listening to Little Atoms, a radio show about ideas and culture.
This episode of Little Atoms was produced and presented by Neil Denny and was broadcast on Resonance 104.4 FM.
You can find the Little Atoms podcast on iTunes and you can follow the show on Twitter at Little Atoms.
If you'd like to donate a little money to support the show, you can do so at littleatoms.com. Thanks for listening.